Here's how I woke up this morning. Donna's mom's up for a visit, and I just sat down at the computer to review my message and to prepare to speak this morning, and I hear, "Steve, the floor's all wet down here." And so the sump pump stopped working overnight, and it backed up, and there's water all over the basement, and I'm like, "Oh, Lord, you got great timing." So we dealt with all that, and on the way here, you know, I was just amazed that I wasn't freaked out and as worried and nervous as I normally would have been in this situation. I just felt like God wanted to meet us this morning, and He has. And He will continue to. We've gone straight from Christmas to Easter because this is the center of our faith. The cross is the center of what we believe. When I was in high school, there was this Christian punk band that I listened to called The Crucified. And they had a song called Crux of the Mosh. And I had no idea what that meant, so I looked it up in a dictionary and I learned that the word crux has been brought into the English language from the Latin. And its original meaning in Latin is cross. But crux, when you use it in English, it means the center, the core, the middle, the decisive point at an issue, the crux of the issue, the place where all things meet. And for Christians, the place where all things meet is the cross. We have a lot of different varieties of crosses. I've put some of them up on the screen for you. You can take your pick of how you want the cross represented, but it all comes down to the same thing. There's the crucifix in the top left corner that still has a picture of Jesus on it. Sometimes Protestants like to beat up the Catholics because we think Jesus is not on the cross anymore. How could you have a picture of Him still on the cross? But He's not here anymore, but we still have a picture of Him here in the manger. It was a point. It was the moment of salvation. The middle cross at the top there is more of an Anglican cross. The one on the right's more of a Celtic cross. The one in the bottom left isn't sacrilegious. That's known as Peter's cross because church tradition tells us that when Peter was crucified, he asked to be hung upside down because he didn't feel like he should share the same death as his Lord. So that's what that represents there. It's not a blasphemy. It's a mark of honor. The one in the middle at the bottom is known as the mission cross because it points to the north, south, east, and west to symbolize the message of the cross going to the whole world. The one on the right is more of an orthodox cross. There's two crossbars at the top. The first one represents when Jesus was put on the cross, there was a plaque put on Him that said, "The King of the Jews." That's what the top line represents, and then the crossbar. And then the bottom angled cross represents the thief on the left and the right-hand side, one of whom repented and one of whom didn't. But it doesn't matter how we draw the cross. It doesn't matter if you wear it around your neck or put it as a sticker on your car. It is the center of our faith. It's the foundation. It's the core of what we believe in. If it wasn't for the cross, we wouldn't be here. There'd be no point in any of this. That's what it all comes down to. We've been looking through the season of Advent at the servant songs from the book of Isaiah. And if you'd turn to Isaiah chapter 52, please. There's four songs, four passages in the book of Isaiah where God talks, or the prophet talks about a servant. A servant who would hear from God and who would obey God and go through things and take God's message to the end of the world. Now, we've looked at the first three servant songs, and we're going to look at the last one today, and it's appropriate today because this is the climax. This is the fourth song is the longest song in terms of verses, and it also gets to the most detail about what Jesus went through. When we looked at the other poems, we first of all considered how it applied to Israel, and then we considered how it applied to Jesus, and then we applied them to ourselves and how we can follow the example of the servant going through life. And I'm going to deviate a little bit from that pattern this morning. Because this passage speaks so clearly about Jesus, even though it was written about 500 years before his birth. It speaks so clearly about him. What we're going to do this morning is just read it and look at what Jesus has done for us and accept it. That's going to be the application for this morning, just to hear again from the start to the end what Jesus did for us and accept it and worship him for it. So Isaiah 52, starting at verse 13, and I'm going to read right to the end of chapter 53, the fourth servant song. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up, and he shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Sprinkle is a sacrificial term. He will sprinkle many nations. And the kings will shut their mouths because of him. That's a great phrase. Shut your mouth. The kings will shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see. And that which they have not heard, they understand. For who has believed what he has heard? And to who, from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant. Just think about the life of Jesus. Like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. He had no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows, he was acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. And we esteemed him not. But surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. And this might sound a little familiar. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Doesn't it just blow your mind that 500 years before Jesus made an appearance on the globe, this was written? Man. He was oppressed. He was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and for his generation who considered that he was cut off for the land of the living, he was stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. And here's one of the most ominous verses in the Bible. It was the will of the Lord to crush him, to put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. The will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. And out of the anguish of his soul, he will see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. He will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many. He will divide spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered among the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many, and he makes intercession for the transgressors. There's a lot there, and it's heavy, and I make no apologies for it. This is the center. This is why we are who we are, that Jesus died for us. We're going to look just briefly at six things that Jesus did for us from this passage, six ways Jesus acted on our behalf. And the first one is this: Jesus confounded the rulers. He made the kings shut their mouth. Jesus shocked the rulers and the powerful people in this world. No one expected him to appear the way he did. And I love the way this poem, it talks so strongly about Jesus suffering and the stripes and being crushed and everything. But before any of that, right up at the start, it talks about Jesus will sprinkle many nations and that he will be exalted. Right from the start, he tells us the good news. And I don't know if you've heard this joke, but a doctor called a patient and says, "I have good news and I have bad news." The patient said, "Oh, what's the bad news?" He says, "You have 24 hours, or what's the good news?" He says, "Oh, you have 24 hours to live." "That's the good news. What's the bad news?" "Forgot to call you yesterday." Sorry, I couldn't. I like that one. Right from the start of this poem, it's almost like a good news, bad news thing. God has good news and he has bad news. The bad news is that Jesus will be crushed. He will suffer for our sakes. But the good news, right from the very start, he gives the good news. It's that Jesus will be exalted. And because of how Jesus showed up, because of Jesus' appearance, everyone in the world was amazed. In fact, it's proportionate. Because Jesus was humbled so low, think about how Jesus was humbled. God beyond all time, existing beyond time and space, the King of the universe, decides to be born like this. It's amazing. I have a suspicion that from the amount babies cry, they suffer a little bit in their early little lives. But Jesus, that was the first step. Jesus was born as one of us, the King of the universe. He was humbled. Man. But it didn't end there. He lived among a people that didn't listen to him. He ministered for 3 active years. And for 3 years, sure, crowds came and crowds went. But in the end, the crowd said, "Crucify him." And in the end, his people didn't listen to what he had to say. It was his death and the ministry launched beyond his people that was accomplished after. The King of the universe and people not listening to you. It's amazing. And then, of course, we know what Jesus went through. We know that he suffered. He was unjustly accused of crimes he didn't commit. But he willingly went to the cross and he willingly died for our sakes. He bore our sins so we wouldn't have to bear them. Jesus was humbled, but just as much as he was humbled, the Bible says, so he is exalted. Everyone loves a comeback story. How many people remember the 1984 version of The Karate Kid? Do you remember that movie? That was an important one for me. I don't know. I watched it so many times. And I don't know if you remember the last fight. But the last fight, the dirty guy that was cheating and tricking and everything. He was winning the fight. He was destroying him. And the Karate Kid was lying there wounded. And he was beat up and everything. And do you remember that? I shouldn't even try it. But he gets up on the one leg and does this. And then he does that super kick and blows him. And he wins at the end. And you know what made that scene so powerful was that he was so far down and he still pulled out the victory. If he would have walked in and beat everyone up and won the fights, it would have been all right, but it wouldn't have been good. What made that thing so exciting was that he was so down, he was so wounded, he was unjustly attacked, but yet he came through with the victory in the end. That's what makes Jesus' story. That's one part of what makes Jesus' story so compelling. He was down in the count. No, man, when a Messiah is crucified, that's usually the end of his story. There were other Messiahs. I've told you this many times, but it's so important. There were many Messiahs around Jesus' time. There were many people that stood up and said, "I'm God's chosen one. Follow me." And every one of them was killed. Every one of them was killed. And when they were killed, that was the end of their movement. All the people that followed him kind of went off to their own houses and went to live their own lives and pretended they weren't involved in that uprising for when the Romans came by. That's how it always happened. It happened before Jesus and it happened with false messiahs after him. But with Jesus, something different. It looked like he was out. He was crucified. For any other messiah, that would have been the end. But for Jesus, it was different. I watched Toy Story 3 yesterday. You've seen that? Seen the toys? I hope I don't give this away if you haven't seen it, but the toys are going down the conveyor belt in the garbage dump into the trash fire at the bottom, and it gets worse and worse. Oh, you haven't seen it yet? You know what? I'll have mercy on you. Never mind, I won't tell you that one. We'll stick with the Karate Kid story. You know, those of you who have seen it know where I'm going. The worse it looks, the more powerful the victory. And Jesus, as low as he was crushed, he is exalted today beyond anything we can imagine or think. It's amazing. And I'm thankful that this is typically how God works. I wanted to turn to 1 Corinthians. This is another famous passage, favorite passage for me because it gives me hope. 1 Corinthians 1. The kings shut their mouths because of Jesus. They don't have anything to say because Jesus shocked them and utterly amazed them. They had nothing to say. How on earth could God use such a weak, destroyed, crushed person as Jesus to bring about his salvation? The kings were just like, this can't be. This can't happen. But that's typically how God likes to work, and it gives me hope. 1 Corinthians 1:25. Beautiful passage. Consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to the world standards. Not many of you were powerful. Not many of you were noble. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being may boast in the presence of God. God chose us. It doesn't matter what your social status is. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter what you've done with your life to this point. God has chosen you to bring about his work. And if he can work with Jesus, who in the eyes of the world looked like a complete failure, God demonstrated his power through that, though. He was not a failure, but he looked like it. If God can use Jesus, he can use us too. This is how God works. Jesus confounded the rulers. Secondly, and I've kind of touched on this, Jesus lived a humble life. The chapter 53 of Isaiah starts with this: who has believed what we have said? Who on earth can possibly believe this? I had a book growing up, a Ripley's Believe It or Not book, and it had all the... Madison, you have one? Yeah. It has all those crazy things, and you're like, I can't believe it, but it's true. That's how Isaiah 53 starts out. Who on earth could believe this story that the king of the universe would choose to die and be humbled and be crushed for our sins? It's unbelievable. It says that Jesus was nothing special to the eyes. He had no physical appearance that we should be drawn to him. The Sunday school pictures, I don't know if we have any pictures of Jesus in frames. Jesus always looks prettier than I think he was. We don't know a whole lot about Jesus. I had a prof said this. I think I may have shared it before, and I won't give you the punchline now, but there's only one physical description of Jesus in the Bible, and I'll tell you about it if you talk to me after the service. But you can't draw a picture from it on the Sunday school wall. Jesus had nothing attractive about his appearance. In fact, he was crushed. He was called a man of suffering. And when people suffer, other people hide their faces. And that's what they did to Jesus. When he suffered, people hid their faces from him because they felt awkward. They didn't know what to do. They didn't want to be around him. Peter said, no, I don't know who that man is. And I thought we could draw just a little bit of a lesson from that. You know, when people are sick, even today, their friends don't know how to act. It's a typical thing. I see it quite a bit. I don't know how to act either when people are sick or seriously ill. But what you find is when someone is seriously ill, they'll tend to withdraw from their friends and withdraw from their company. It's kind of a typical thing to do. And the friends that used to be around them never are quite sure what to say, and they feel awkward, so they kind of just keep their distance a little bit more than usual, which just makes the problem worse. That's what happened with Jesus. He was being crucified. He was suffering. He was dying. He was acquainted with sorrows. And all of a sudden, the people that followed him just kind of thought, oh, yeah, I know I said I'd follow you, but you're kind of awkward looking right now. I'm not sure. I think this is the end. If you know people who are sick right now, who are suffering, take extra time with them. Don't withdraw. Jesus lived a humble life. Jesus suffered and died for our sins. And this is the amazing thing. Jesus was innocent. He lived a completely spotless life. I don't think many of us could say that. I won't ask for a show of hands. Maybe some of us haven't committed any big sins in 2011, but I'm reading this book at home, and it's one of the best books I've read in ages. I recommend it to anyone. It's called Sabbath, and it's this person's just reflections on the Sabbath and on what Sabbath means for us. And he starts his book by saying, he mentions that whenever anyone talks about the Sabbath, when people write about the Sabbath, they always start by saying, don't be legalistic, don't be legalistic, don't be legalistic. And he said, that's true, we shouldn't be legalistic. But here's how he starts his book. The fourth commandment says, honor the Sabbath. It's a commandment. None of us would think that we could break the thou shalt not kill commandment with impunity, or break the have no other gods before God commandment without impunity, but I'm reading this book on the Sabbath and thinking, man. And he's not talking about Sundays. He's talking about one day a week, a Sabbath. Anyways, that's another message. But that's just a side one. But that just reminds me of how far from God we fall. How far we wander. We are guilty, but Jesus wasn't. Jesus lived a perfect life. But just like the rest of the human beings around him, he suffered and died for sins that weren't his own. That's the amazing thing. We wandered like sheep, and God punished the servant. If you're a normal human being, you're thinking, that's not fair. How can it be fair that God punished an innocent person for the crimes of the guilty people around him? It's not fair. And you'd be right, it's absolutely not fair. But it's something that Jesus chose to do. It's something that the Father chose to do. In fact, that haunting verse, it was the will of God to crush him with pain. They planned this from the foundations of the world. Before Jesus came and appeared in a manger, they had worked out the plan of salvation. They had known, they knew what they were going to do, and they decided that they loved the world so much, they were willing to suffer like that for our sake. It's amazing. Jesus obeyed his Father. They planned the whole thing, and God works through his suffering. There's a C.S. Lewis quote on the next screen. This is a famous one from The Problem of Pain. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, but he shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And if you've watched the biopic of his life, that they made a lot of that phrase. God and his Son, the Father and the Son, they worked through suffering. Through suffering, Jesus saved us all. And that's still how God works sometimes. When you're suffering from something, rather than blaming God, rather than coming to him and saying, God, how on earth could you allow this to happen? When your basement floods Sunday morning, just before you're supposed to be speaking, rather than saying, God, how on earth could you allow this to happen? Or, you know, in Guantanamo, sleep deprivation is torture. But if you're a parent of a newborn, it just... God even uses that. You know, talk to Donna, or I'll tell you right now, we have prayed more than ever these last 8 months. Because when your baby's crying and you're up with them in the middle of the night, what else do you do? God is you. Those are mild cases of suffering compared to the suffering in the world. But God uses anything to get our attention and to draw our hearts back to him. If you're suffering something, rather than blaming God or accusing him for it, why don't you ask him, Lord, what are you trying to teach me through this? Jesus was rewarded. He received the ultimate payoff, if you could put it that way. Because of his obedience, because he died for our crimes, and innocently he was willing to do that. Because of that, and I've already said part of this, he was exalted as high as he was brought low. So as bad as it looked, he is exalted that high. I read the first chapter of Revelation. It's just amazing, the picture of Jesus you have here. He's blinding. It's brilliant. Jesus was exalted as high as he was brought low. But Isaiah says a little bit more about him. Isaiah says that out of his anguish, He will see light, and he will find satisfaction through the knowledge that he made many people righteous. Even in his pain, Jesus was able to see light. Even in the darkness, he was able to take satisfaction in knowing that despite everything he was going through, he was saving people. Not just in that time, but all throughout time. He was rescuing people because he was dying. And he found satisfaction in that. Jesus was rewarded. And the last thing before I read a little story and then we're going to take communion together is Jesus interceded for us. That's the last verse. I will divide him a portion with the many. He will divide the spoil with the strong because he poured out his soul to death. He did everything he could. He poured out his soul until he died. There's nothing more he could do. Jesus went to the last degree. And because of that, he made intercession for the transgressors, for the crime, for the criminals, for people like us. Because Jesus was able to go to the last degree of obedience, he was able to intercede with the Father on our behalf. And because of what Jesus did, we are rescued. And that's the core of our faith. I read a lot of words from that and made a lot of points. But there's a story, a brief story that came to my mind when I started preparing for this. It's 4 pages long and it puts all this into vivid perspective. So what I'm going to do to close our service is read this story, and immediately following I'd ask the communion attendants to come on up, begin distributing the elements, and we're going to sing a few more praise songs. But just listen to this story before we do that. It's called Rag Man. It's by a Christian author named Walter Wangren.